Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Fiberboard Corporation versus Poole.
May it please the court, Mr. Larry Carlson and Mr. Andy Hunnett have argued for the petitioner, reserving 10 minutes for rebuttal, and Mr. Carlson will argue for 15 minutes.
It please the court, Mr. Sadler, Mr. Houston. I represent Owens, Illinois. I have the privilege this morning of speaking on behalf of all of the petitioners with respect to the points that are common to us. Because of time limitations, I intend to talk about three of those points. The first is the admission of the Sumner-Simpson correspondence without any limitation whatsoever. The second is our challenge to the award of punitive damages. And the third is the admission of the grisly autopsy photographs. After I'm through, Mr. Conant will speak briefly about his client, Garlock.
With regard to the Sumner-Simpson papers, isn't it a fact that there's more than one Fifth Circuit case that has allowed the admission of these papers, and that they have under similar circumstances in this case, how could the trial court's admission of these Simpson papers be an abuse of discretion?
You are absolutely correct, Justice Gonzalez. The Fifth Circuit has held that those letters come in for a very limited purpose, and the purpose is constructive knowledge to show what other companies, not what they actually know, but what they could have or should have known. Where the trial court, and let me say before I go on to that, that there's a split in the courts on admissibility. There are other courts that have held to the contrary and have not let this evidence in for any purpose. Those courts include the Fourth Circuit. There's also a California case that holds that it does not come in, period. Our complaint about the trial court's conduct with respect to this evidence is twofold. First is the question of admissibility that you address. We contend the Fourth Circuit got it right. The Fifth Circuit got it wrong. This court has not spoken to the issue. We ask this court to hold that the correspondence is irrelevant and inadmissible. The primary reason, Your Honor, it has no relevance in this case is these letters don't say anything about insulation products. Insulation products are what this case was about. Those products typically contain a small percentage of asbestos. All the Sumner-Simpson letters go to is the question whether pure asbestos or raw asbestos is capable of causing the disease asbestosis. That was a non-issue in this case because the defense lawyers, in our opening statement, conceded that at least since the 1930s, it has been known that asbestos can cause the disease asbestosis. But beyond that, Your Honor, and perhaps more important, is the question of the limiting instruction. On the question of admissibility, there are cases that have gone both ways. They can point to some Fifth Circuit cases that say the evidence should come in. There is no case, though, that I'm aware of, and I don't believe that there is any precedent, Your Honor, for what the trial court did here, and that is to allow this evidence to come in, including all of the parts that had to do with the wrongdoing and with the misconduct by these companies that were not even parties to this lawsuit, and to refuse and to decline the repeated request by the defense lawyers for a limiting instruction that would have limited the evidence to its proper purpose. Again, I don't believe there is any authority, there is no appellate opinion, there is no case law that supports that conduct by the trial court. In fact, even the Texarkana Court of Appeals, which affirmed this case 3-0, agreed that the part of the Sumner-Simpson letters that had to do with the cover-up by these companies that were not parties to this lawsuit and were not at trial should have been deleted. Even the Texarkana Court of Appeals held that at least one of the limiting instructions that the defendants requested was proper and could indeed have been given by the trial court. Even the Texarkana Court of Appeals, which affirmed 3-0, agreed that it would be improper for one to argue, based upon the misconduct documented in this evidence by non-parties, companies that were not defendants and not at trial, that the defendants who were at trial should be punished for that. And yet despite...
Then get you to the analysis of whether or not there was harmful error or not.
Well, the first question is, was there error? I think there wasn't letting it in at all. Certainly there was. On the question of the limited instruction, again, there's no authority that supports that. In terms of did that probably cause the rendition of an improper verdict? Was it harmful error? I think that it was. Your Honor, it was bad enough that the evidence came in without a limiting instruction. The icing on the cake, in terms of harmful error, is the argument that plaintiff's counsel made to the jury in closing argument.
Was there any objection made by you to that?
We didn't object to the argument, Your Honor, because there was no objection that we could have made.
Why not?
Well, the evidence was in for all purposes. There was no limitation upon the use of the evidence.
But there was no objection or request for a limiting instruction at the time of argument.
Yes, that's correct.
The icing on the cake. And was it your position throughout this trial that manufacturers of asbestos insulation product were unaware of the dangers of asbestos in the 1930s?
No, to the contrary, our position was the companies were aware that pure or raw asbestos, if you're exposed to enough of it at high enough levels for a long enough period of time, could cause the disease asbestosis. The case went to the hazards, if any, to users of the insulation products, which contained only a small percentage of asbestos.
So it was your contention that in the 30s, your manufacturers were unaware of the dangers of asbestos insulation?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. To get back to the point of harmful error, what happened here during argument is plaintiff's counsel actually read to the jury from these letters, not anything having to do with information or knowledge, but what he read to the jury were the parts of the letters having to do with wrongdoing, with serious offensive misconduct by companies who were not even parties to this lawsuit. He asked the jurors, go back in the jury room, ladies and gentlemen, read this correspondence, and he said, quote, see if it makes your blood boil just a little bit. It really should.
Made them blood boil to 10 to 5 million pennies.
It absolutely did, Your Honor. And on the subject, the specific subject of punitive damages, what plaintiff's counsel told that jury during closing argument in the context of a discussion about this correspondence was, quote, see how it affects you because you're going to be asked about punitive and exemplary damages. In summary, it should not have come in. If it did come in, it should have come with some sort of limitation or limiting instruction. It did not. Plaintiff's counsel was then allowed to, and he did, argue to this jury that we should be punished because of misconduct by companies that were not parties to this lawsuit. Let me turn now to the question of punitive damages. This court is already no doubt familiar with the United States Supreme Court's Hayslip decision. In Hayslip, the United States Supreme Court upheld the Alabama system for awarding punitive damages in the face of a procedural due process challenge. The Alabama system is different from the Texas system in a number of different respects. What I want to do this morning is to focus upon one difference that I think is absolutely critical in the context of mass tort litigation like the asbestos cases. Under Alabama law, when a jury makes an award of punitive damages, after that verdict, but before judgment, the trial court is required to conduct an evidentiary hearing to determine whether the particular award is excessive or not. In making that determination, the trial court is required by law to consider 8 specific factors. They're referred to as the Green Oil Hornsby factors. The trial court is then required to make a record of its decision and the bases for that decision. One of the Green Oil Hornsby factors noted by the U.S. Supreme Court in its Hayslip decision is whether other awards have been rendered against the particular defendant for the same conduct.
That's not your contention that in Hayslip, the United States Supreme Court defined the Alabama standards, all 8 of those, as being the minimum required for due process, is it?
We're not contending that, Your Honor. We know from Hayslip that the Alabama system is enough, that it meets the constitutional requirements. What the court did not tell us is what the minimum level of compliance is.
And as far as this question of multiple imposition of punitive damage awards, while Alabama may have recognized that as one of its eight factors, is there any court in the world that has approved the argument that you're making today concerning multiple imposition of punitive damages specifically?
Well, there are two components of the argument. One is a straightforward substantive due process argument. There is at least one court in the world that has accepted that argument by itself, and that's the District Court of New Jersey in the Justwin decision. Beyond
a reported decision?
Yes, Your Honor. It's cited in our briefs. Beyond that, you get to the question, does the system have enough procedural safeguards to at least allow trial courts to consider this factor? In the mass tort case, when a defendant has been hit again and again and again and again, our point is that was part of the system that was approved by the U.S. Supreme Court. The Texas system does not have anything like that.
Well, as far as this specific question of multiple imposition of punitive damages, we've got a district court. Is that a state or a federal district court?
Federal district court in New Jersey.
Federal district court in New Jersey that has accepted that argument. And then what courts have specifically rejected the argument that you're making to us today?
Well, what commonly happens is, for example, the Fifth Circuit.
In
an en banc decision, decided not to go with that argument. A number of panels since then, including some cited by my opponent, have said we're bound by that prior decision, but we have serious misgivings about this, and we believe that the arguments against this have merit. The Second Circuit, Your Honor, has also held that the arguments have merit, but has held on the cases that have come before it that the particular record was insufficient to establish that the basis for the prior awards was the same as the basis for this one.
What type of record do we have before us on that issue in this case?
Well, Your Honor, we were limited in the record that we would make because the Texas system does not have the kind of procedural mechanism that the U.S. Supreme Court approved in Haislip.
But you did not try to make any bill of exceptions to give proof under what you would consider an improved procedural mechanism.
Well, we had a couple of choices. I suppose an argument could be made that theoretically it would have been possible for us to tell this jury in a non-bifurcated trial in which we were defending our conduct and contesting negligence that there had been prior punitive damage awards against us. We had been found guilty of gross negligence before.
That's a two-edged sword, is it not?
Excuse me?
Two-edged sword.
More like a one-edged.
Well, you're telling the jury that look at all these other juries that have looked at this conduct and awarded punitive damages. On the one hand, don't hit us again for what we've been hit before, and on the other hand, you're trying to argue, well, our conduct is not that egregious, don't allow any punitive damages.
If you could bifurcate the question of punitive damages from the balance of the trial, the system might be workable, but as I understand this court's Ali versus Hughes decision, we can't do that. So as you indicate, Judge Gonzalez, that as a realistic or practical matter is just not a workable alternative. What we tried to do, Justice Phillips, the best we could, was after verdict, we introduced affidavits by our people that documented some of the facts that we would like to prove, given the opportunity by witnesses and additional documents at the kind of hearing that the U.S. Supreme Court approved in Haislip. So there are
Is that Alabama hearing before the fact finder as well, or is it just before the trial judge?
Just before the trial judge.
And so it goes only to remittiture, or does the trial judge in fact set the punitive damages under the Alabama system?
Both. The ultimate determination is whether the particular award, in light of the goals of deterrence and punishment, should be upheld, reduced, or set aside. And then the Alabama scheme approved by the U.S. Supreme Court directs that in making that determination, the trial court hears evidence and considers eight specific factors that are relevant to that inquiry, makes its finding, and then makes a record of those findings. And again, it's the particular factor having to do with prior awards that is not part of the Texas system that we think is just absolutely critical in this kind of
In that hearing that you had before the trial judge after the verdict, did you put in that type of evidence?
We did the best we could.
A bill, essentially.
We did the best we could by affidavits with our motions for new trial.
Well, I have two questions about that. The first is, then I gather you made a strategic decision as counsel for your client not to present this matter to the jury that there had been these prior punitive damage awards because you thought it would do your client more harm than good.
We made that decision. It would have been suicidal, Your Honor, to introduce that evidence to the jury.
And second, with reference to what you did do, it was not a formal bill of exceptions. It was the filing of a couple of affidavits, was it not?
It was affidavits with our motion for new trial. And in addition, Your Honor, we raised these constitutional objections at every step in the proceeding.
And as far as those affidavits were concerned, there was no opportunity for your opponent to test the truthfulness of the affiant, was there?
That is absolutely correct, as there would be in the kind of evidence you're hearing that we asked this court to adopt.
And with reference to those affidavits, can you tell us specifically how much money Owings Corning had actually paid out to people in punitive damages at the time this case was tried?
I have those Owings, Illinois situation. The trial was we had been assessed with awards, had not paid any. Since then, we've paid some.
Had not paid any at the time of trial?
That is correct, Your Honor. Celotex's situation, by contrast, they had paid $175,000, had had several million assessed against them. The affidavits also addressed other factors pertinent to the green oil calculus. For example, the fact that Owings, Illinois is out of pocket some $70 million in this litigation and things of that sort.
So at the time of trial, you were challenging on appeal every one of the punitive damage awards that had been assessed against your client or adjusted against your client? Not you personally, but they were appealing.
None, I can confirm that none had been paid as of the date the record was made. Situation that was not true with respect to some of the defendants.
Do you know, as of this point in time, whether any state other than Texas is still assessing punitive damages as a matter of course at the same time that liability is determined in an asbestos suit?
Your Honor, I probably ought to address that if it's important by supplemental brief. I don't know,
probably,
frankly, the system
probably not that
on bifurcation in other states. I do believe that this court's Alley versus Hughes decision does not allow us to pursue that alternative in Texas.
If, for the sake of argument, that we were to accept your argument that repeated exposure to punitive damages violates due process, what standards would you ask us to impose?
Your Honor, I would suggest that this court adopt the standards that the United States Supreme Court approved in the Haslip case. The ultimate decision is whether a particular award, in light of prior awards, is excessive in light of the purposes of punitive damages, which are punishment and deterrence. And toward that end, the trial court in the Haslip system is instructed on 8 specific factors that are relevant to that inquiry. They are all relevant. We know that system meets constitutional muster. I think it's a good system. We would ask this court to adopt it. Mr. Conant will now speak to the court briefly.
You are not, you'll just stand on your brief on the photographs.
I'm out of time, Your Honor. I will unless it comes up anyway.
May it please the court, I'm Al Conant representing Garlock. The only way that the judgment against Garlock can be affirmed is if this court announces a new rule of absolute, not strict liability. That rule would have to say that asbestos in any product is inherently and unreasonably dangerous, and that the manufacturers have always known that, and that all products are substantial contributors to whatever the harm that's being claimed is. That's what it would take on this record to get the Garlock. There was not a single article cited by the plaintiff's epidemiological expert which dealt with encapsulated asbestos in gaskets or in valve packing. There was not a single medical expert who testified about encapsulated asbestos, gaskets. No expert put on the stand by the plaintiff ever even mentioned Garlock or Garlock's products.
In that regard, sir, this is a no-evidence review on this point.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so we have to disregard all the evidence on your side and look to see whether there's any on the other side. Is that right?
I think that's the first inquiry, yes.
And wasn't there some expert testimony offered in this case that even very small amounts of asbestos exposure could cause this disease?
Yes, Your Honor, there was. One doctor testified to that. He said there was no safe level of asbestos exposure. He also said that he had no scientific backup for that, and that that was his opinion alone.
Wasn't there also some testimony that asbestos dust was released when workers were replacing gasket material?
No, Your Honor, there was not. There was evidence that there was dust when they were removing these gaskets. There was no identification of what that dust may have consisted of.
Couldn't the jury properly infer from the fact that the products contained asbestos and that there was dust from the products that the dust contained asbestos fibers?
Your Honor, they could conceivably infer that, but they could not conceivably infer either, A, that it was asbestos in a sufficient amount to pose an unreasonable risk of harm to human health, and they could not assume that Garlock knew or should have known at the time. And if Garlock didn't know that its product posed any unreasonable risk of harm, then it had no duty to warn. And there is no showing by any evidence that was introduced in this case as to the point at which Garlock knew or should have known that. The doctor who so opined that even a small amount did not, A, tell us what a small amount was, nor B, tell us when he came to that opinion. That plainly, under all the evidence they put on, had been a disputed item from forever and ever. When was it that that should have occurred? If it didn't occur, at some point during the period of time that these workers were being exposed, then Garlock did not have a duty to warn and could not be held liable.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
We move the court. Mr. Paul Sadler will present argument from respondents.
May it please the court. I'm here today on behalf of three working men who are suffering from asbestosis and two families whose husbands and father have died because of cancer from their exposure to asbestos. The history of this litigation, as Justice Gonzalez pointed out earlier, has spanned over 20 years. Most of the issues that you are hearing today have already been decided and have been decided for many years by the Fifth Circuit. I find it a little bit incredible that Owens, Illinois and Celotex come before you today saying repeated punitive damage awards are causing them financial ruin, when at the time of this trial and appeal, they can point to only one case where they have paid Owens, Illinois $500,000, Celotex $175,000. Owens, Illinois says there are 70,000 cases pending against it. It can point to only 7 cases in the entire country where punitive damages were awarded. That's less than 1%, 1%, and less than $4 million.
If they could point to more, would the argument be more persuasive?
I don't think it is. And that's part of the problem in this case. When do you decide punishment is enough, and how do you decide that?
So if they show that there were, let's take an extraordinary number, $1 billion punitive damages, final judgments out there, still, what would you just pay the first one first? Or?
You pay the first one first. Judge, are we going to develop a policy in this state where the guilty party chooses his own punishment?
No, I'm just asking.
I don't think that's a rule that we can adopt or is livable. It is not a good policy for this state. The problem with this litigation and their argument is that this litigation began 20 years ago with a single plaintiff alleging damages for his unique injuries at his particular time of exposure. At that time, in the 20 years since, these cases have been, by and large, handled on a one-on-one basis. Not because they have to be, but because the defendants want it to be that way, and to some extent, so do the plaintiffs. They want their day in court each time. But this exposure occurred over decades. There's a long latency period within the disease, and so it has been impossible to sit down and look at the magnitude of the harm and have one jury assess that. That's never been done. It has never been done. And so it is incredible to argue now, in light of 20 years of litigation, to say at the time of this verdict, we had paid no dollars in punitive damages, but we have since then paid one of $500,000, to say that this court should say that due process prohibits the recovery of punitive damages. That is not a sufficient record.
My question, though, is you're saying it's not going to happen, and they're saying that it is. But if the day should come where it did happen, would the argument, do you agree with the argument that there must be some consideration of multiple punitive damages or not?
No, I do not.
So that even if there were lots of awards and lots of them were being paid, and not all of them could be paid, still, the rule should be, what, first come, first serve?
Well, it's the way our tort system has worked. But the argument that you're making is that because we have killed so many thousands of people, we should not be subject to punitive damages. That argument by the defendant, says, look, we've killed and maimed 70,000 people in this country. By the turn of the century, perhaps 400,000 or 200,000. But because of the enormity of our misconduct, because we have created such horrible, murderous acts, we shouldn't be subject to punitive damages.
Well, they can't be after a point.
Well, at some point, for example, Celotex. For example, Celotex.
At some point, they're going to get into bankruptcy.
Celotex has voluntarily filed bankruptcy.
Well,
and this case, for example, is part of that bankruptcy. And that bankruptcy court will have jurisdiction to determine, not only for this plaintiff, but all other pending claims and future claimants, although that's a large argument to be made, how to take the financial resources of that company and pay these people they have hurt.
Well, these types of cases are placing enormous stress on the tort system. I mean, there's fewer and fewer people that are just died or just get injured.
I can't hear you.
Fewer and fewer people are just died. I mean, we are able now to understand the etiology of a lot of things that 50 years ago we didn't know. There's a tremendous stress being put on the system trying these cases one by one by one. And perhaps not in asbestos. Perhaps most or all of these manufacturers have the money to withstand most or all of the judgments assessed against them. There's no need to get into that. Surely there are a lot of other mass tort cases in the pipeline coming in the next generation. In the development of the common law, does not our court have some responsibility to see that there's a system by which compensation can fairly get to those that are injured without the transaction costs taking such a large percentage of the pot that's available?
Because
that's been the great criticism of asbestos, is not so much that people aren't getting paid, but it's that they're getting such a small percentage, the injured people, relative to what lawyers, insurance adjusters, and expert witnesses are getting.
I think our system does provide a procedure. The problem is the parties choose not to utilize it.
And what is that?
Class action. It has been used on three occasions that I'm aware of. The first one we were involved in. The procedure was approved by the Court of Appeals. We disposed of 1,000, roughly 750 to 1,000 cases. But the defendants don't want to do that. These same companies...
unless both parties want to do it, we just do it one by one until the money comes.
Well, unless one side or the other requests the certification of the class, which either side could. But the fact is, they don't want that. They want to handle these cases one by one.
You don't either.
We have done it before. Our law firm has done that before.
You did in this case, and you could have done it.
We could have in this case, but from our standpoint is... from within our law firm, we had an X number of cases we believed we could handle in this way, in this fashion. That's what we did. But clearly, the defendants have the same opportunity, if they want to handle them in mass, they can.
Both sides do.
Sure they could. But they don't. They don't want to do that. They prefer to handle them one by one and face their judgment day after day, one by one, plaintiff after plaintiff, and then hope that you will come in and change the rules to where they won't be punished, or change the rules that have been engaged for 20 years in the federal court system so that they no longer have to face this suffering they've caused.
Counsel, why shouldn't, if the plaintiff can introduce evidence of the net worth of a defendant and asking the jury to decide what amount of punitive damages would punish or make an example of this defendant because of gross negligence, why shouldn't there be a procedure whereby a defendant could show without compromising their defense to the liability issues what other punitive damage awards to which it's been exposed in giving the jury a fair picture of what its true financial condition is?
No, I think they can. I dispute their statements. I mean, we've been through 20 years of litigation. Over and over again, juries have found them guilty of misconduct for failure to warn, product liability. Nothing prevents them from coming into the courtroom and saying, okay, truth is we knew and we didn't warn, but look, we've got 70,000 people out here to pay. And we need to spread this cost out. In fact, they made that argument in this case. They made the up that very
argument. My question, though, is how could they do that without compromising their right to defend on liability, too?
Well, I think that's a problem that every defendant has in every lawsuit. That's not
a choice.
Sure, Your Honor, that's correct. Every defendant has that choice when he walks in the courtroom. He can admit the claims of the plaintiff and argue only damages, or he can contest every single issue. They choose to contest over and over and over again every single issue. I think it's important for us to understand the context of this appeal. There has been no factual sufficiency or no evidence point raised about the finding of gross negligence as to these defendants, Owens, Illinois, and Celotex. There has been no claim anywhere by these defendants that the amount of punitive damages awarded was excessive. So what do you have before you? They have avenues they can pursue under the Texas system. Instead, they come in, they didn't take advantage of those avenues, but they come in and say the entire system per se is unconstitutional. And when you do that, we'll be the first state in this country to hold the Texas common law method unconstitutional per se. And we will do what the federal court, who has reviewed our procedure in the Glasscock and King opinions, has refused to do. In fact, said, you meet the Hayslip requirements. And the United States Supreme Court denied writ in both cases.
Point, would you give me that case again?
It's the Glasscock versus Armstrong and King versus Armstrong opinions. Both of them are cases that I argued. Both have been affirmed since this appeal. Both of them are cited in the brief. So, to
Counselor,
take this...
Counselor, are you aware of any other state right now where punitive damages are being tried in asbestos cases at the same time as liability?
I haven't done a review of the different states, Your Honor. I simply don't know. I just simply don't know the answer to that. I am aware before this court, and I want to quickly get into Sumner Simpson and the punitive damage, the arguments they've made, but I want to state also that I am aware before this court are cases that are challenging the Burke Royalty Standard Review. But it is important that we understand that that issue is not here because they do not bring forward a no evidence point. They do not. Fiberboard made the no evidence argument for the Court of Appeals but did not bring it forward. Owens, Illinois, and Teletex never claim that there's not sufficient evidence. They never say we're not guilty of gross negligence before the Court of Appeals. They admit we have sufficient evidence to hold them grossly negligent to find them guilty of that. They admit this award is not excessive. It is reasonable. But what they want you to do is hold it violative of the Constitution because of some other case involving another individual with different exposure, with different injuries, and say this man cannot recover, or these people can't recover. If we carry that logic forward, how do we handle mass torts of Delta plane crash, for example? Do we let the first plaintiff that races to the courthouse in a friendly forum and recover punitives foreclose the other 490 plaintiffs? No, you can't do that. They choose to handle these one by one, one by one. And when they do that, our system only allows us to handle punitive damages in this manner. The Sumner Simpson argument on limited instruction, I think it's very important. They have pointed to the argument that was made, the first argument made by the plaintiff. I don't apply the significance to it, they do. But if you will follow that argument, and the bottom line on this abuse of on this issue, on the Sumner Simpson limited instruction, is was there confusion about this evidence? If you will look in the argument,
Where is that in the argument, counsel?
In Mr. Stamm's argument on behalf of Owens, Illinois.
Page
2918 of volume 16. He says, so where is the evidence that these defendants, not Johns Manville, not Raymark, as Mr. Houston keeps throwing up to you, knew that insulators were at risk? None. None. And I challenge Mr. Sadler, who's going to talk to you later, to come up with something. Well, I answer. If you look on page 2997 of the same volume, I'm sorry, starting on page 2995. My answer. So let's talk about asbestos, Mr. Stamm. I accept your challenge. Let's talk about these companies, and we'll start with yours. Let me read you the truth. Kalo, his product, Owens, Illinois, reading from the Saranac Laboratory documents, which are his corporate documents. And then I read, dated 1948, when they knew that it produced asbestosis, 2 years before any of these men began work. And then I continue reading, in 1948, this company's documents, that the company should be forewarned, and that the company being forewarned will be in a better position to institute adequate control measures for safeguarding exposed employees, protecting its own interests. What did you know, Mr. Stamm? Talking about Owens, Illinois. Then I go on. Celotex, what did you know? Same page. Dr. Mancuso, reading from his report to the president of Celotex. Specific documents against Celotex. Then I go on. What did you know, Fiberboard? And I talk about the evidence as to Fiberboard. Was there confusion over the Sumner Simpson documents? Absolutely not. It was borne out in argument. It was presented separately, and it was explained to the jury. And understand again, there was no claim of excessiveness of this verdict. They argue about make your blood boil, and Justice Gonzalez said maybe made them boil to $5 million in punitives. They don't complain about the amount. They had the opportunity to do that, but they didn't.
Just before we leave the Sumner Simpson papers, why wasn't it harmful error to not have a limiting instruction?
I think for a number of reasons. The limiting instruction they offered, and I understand it followed the King trial, which we were involved in, and counsel for Celotex was involved in also. The instruction they offered was different from King. They could have submitted the same instruction, but they didn't. And the submission that they did make of that instruction was so broad that it negated the presumptions of Burrell versus Fiberboard, which is the very first opinion of asbestos. It also, in my opinion, negates Williams versus Steve's Industry. And so for those reasons, it was improper. It was incumbent upon them to give a proper instruction. King was already before them. They could have, but they didn't. They gave the wrong instruction. And I think it's important for us to understand, too, the Fifth Circuit has never, ever adopted a rule saying that limited instruction is necessary for this evidence. Contrary to what Mr. Carlson said, Jackson, D'Artes, Gideon all had Sumner Simpson without limiting instruction. What difference does it make if perhaps in some of those cases Raymark was a party? Their position is still the same. It's not us, it's them. Okay? There was no limiting instruction in any of those and was admissible. The reason it came in the King and Glasscock is because the federal judge Hall wanted to put it in. We had specific corporate documents as to Celotex, and it didn't matter to us because we didn't think the Williams versus Steve's Industry case was involved. But the Fifth Circuit has never adopted a limiting instruction view.
Counsel,
yes,
can you respond to the argument made that the judgment against Garlock cannot and should not stand unless we have absolute liability? What can you point to this record that there's some evidence that support the judgment against Garlock?
Your Honor, I have detailed out specifically that first, the evidence offered. We offered specific evidence on the jury findings from Dr. Joseph Wagner and the literature search, from Mr. Charles Flint, who was the purchasing agent that testified that Garlock was used throughout the plants, that he never saw a warning. The plaintiff's testimony, where they say that dust was emitted, and I might say they say there was no distinction between whether or not it was asbestos or not.
Yes.
Their own expert admitted there was asbestos released.
From the gaskets?
Yes, sir, from the gaskets. They did tests in 1983 that showed asbestos being released. Now, they say, well, it's not enough to harm you. Our expert says it is. That's a jump ball. The jury decides, yes, it is. But Dr. Cooper And the tests that were performed in 1983 clearly have asbestos involved in that duct. So their own experts show that.
Is that the only evidence responding to the counsel's answer to my question that concerning whether Garlock knew?
No. Dr. Cooper, in a moment of breath of fresh air on cross-examination, agreed with Dr. Henshaw that by the 1930s we all knew asbestos was dangerous. And he said if it had been my responsibility, I would have known. We all would have known. That's their own expert. Back in the 1930s, the 1940s. Now, this very argument that, well, it was dangerous in one product, but that's not our product, has been before the court before. If you look in the Jackson opinion, I don't know if it's the first, second, or third, but the site starts 750 Fed Second. That precise argument was made and rejected, and the court said, surely you don't believe that if gasoline is dangerous in one source, they don't use the word gasoline, but they say that if asbestos is dangerous in one source, it's at least some evidence that it may be dangerous in another. But the literature, I take issue with them. Dr. Wagner did talk about packing materials. Garlock furnished, by according to Mr. Flint, the purchasing agent at Texas Eastman, not only gasket material, but also packing material that was used throughout the plant. So there is ample evidence in the record to support the jury finding, and that point should simply be overruled.
Counsel, Mr. Carson didn't have an opportunity to talk about the gruesomeness of the photographs. What's your brief response about there was no error made in the introduction of the photographs?
Your Honor, there was no error in the introduction of those photographs for the simple reason that, one, they were relevant to a disputed fact. That is the cause of death, of Mr. Freeman. And they were relevant to issues or portrayed.
How does the photograph show cause of death?
They show the involvement of asbestos in the cause of death.
Didn't the records show that?
Well, I suppose you can argue that.
Well,
let me ask
didn't,
you this. I understand.
Didn't they?
I don't think they did. Now, in the objection, I take that back. In Chambers, in the objection, they mentioned that the doctor can testify about hyaline plaques, and it is mentioned in the autopsy report. But here's what they did. In voir dire, they start out saying that smoking caused this man's death. In opening statement, listen to these statements, that he died a victim of cigarette smoke, that he smoked himself to death, that in Mr. Freeman there were no asbestos bodies, no asbestos fibers were found in his lungs. Listen, quote, without clear evidence of asbestos-related asbestosis or asbestos bodies, then the lung cancer was caused by cigarette smoking. They laid the challenge down. We did not. But we have to answer it. Now, if someone said that about you, what more persuasive point of evidence is there than a picture saying that's the asbestos, that's the involvement in the lung by a board-certified pathologist? They can bring doctors from New York and everywhere in the world and dispute what someone says in a report, but they cannot dispute that picture, and that's why it was so important.
It's a pretty gruesome photograph.
I don't think they're that gruesome, Your Honor. And besides that, gruesomeness of the photograph alone has not kept photographs out. We allow them in criminal cases to show cause of death. We allow the most burned, charred victim in the world to be shown to a jury for his injuries. But are we saying that with a board-certified pathologist explaining each picture that we're not going to allow that? I think that's absurd. We put adults in the jury box. And I think that issue is important because it begs this question, was prejudice or bias involved in this verdict, correct? Where was the challenge that the actual damages awarded were excessive? There was none. Where was the challenge that the causation finding was wrong, absent Garlock? There was none. So how have they been harmed? It is not harmful error if wrongfully admitted, and I submit to you that it was not wrongfully submitted. The only limitation, and I need to point out that no objection was ever made to the cumulative nature of the photographs. Judge Grant points that out in the Texarkana opinion. They had the opportunity to do that, and they did not. But he details in his opinion each photograph and why it was relevant, and he does an excellent job with it, and it shows that board-certified testimony. The bottom line, even if you say it was an abuse of discretion, which I don't believe it was, they have not been harmed and have not demonstrated their any harm. It is an abuse of standard of review. I want to talk just a minute, because I don't know what they're going to talk about on rebuttal, about the issue of the building specifications and military specs. It is important for us to realize that these defendants, that no evidence was excluded, absolutely none, concerning safety standards by the government. They seem to imply that because they call them government military specifications. But that's not true. They may have been military specifications, but that is not to mean they were government safety standards. Every one of those were admitted into evidence. None of them were excluded. The OSHA guidelines, the threshold limit values, the ACGIH documents, the United States Public Health Service documents, the various health ordinances by the state of Texas were all admitted into evidence. What they're talking about and wanting you to reverse this case now, for example, on the building codes, Judge Grant puts in the footnote of this opinion the evidence by Cole and Henshaw, their expert. Of course, it is used for prevention of fire. I'm sure that many, many building codes have demanded the use. I'm sure that many, many building codes, no identification of which ones, no implication that these men ever worked in them. And what are we talking about? We're talking about specifications of a product in a building. That is not related in any form or fashion to the duty to warn. That's the basis of the gross negligence claim. It is absurd to reverse this case on that type of vague and very broad, generalized testimony. The military specs. There's no evidence these men ever worked in the military. The only case they point to is the guard case out of California, where the employee or the man there worked in the naval shipyard, putting asbestos in the hulls of ships and submarines. That doesn't apply to us. Any more than you can say that the asbestos in the Supreme Court building that's being removed, because the state of Texas built that building, you and your secretaries don't have or should not be warned of the danger. It's an absurd proposition they make. And yet they ask you to reverse on that basis. And they say in the light of the context, well, it's part of our conduct to be judged by. We're not alleging gross negligence in the use of products. We're alleging those gross negligence in when you used them, you didn't warn of the dangers. It's a separate issue. And that's why those vague military specs and building codes that do not even apply to our plaintiffs were properly excluded. The other issue is the damage issue. Damage issue question number 17 that I want us to talk about. If you look at the charge in this case, and if you view that issue as a whole, that damage question as a whole, which I think is important to do, it is clearly, when that question is viewed as a whole, clearly one element of damage submitted one time. And it is not with its own blanks, part of pain, suffering, and mental anguish, and loss of enjoyment of life. Loss of capacity of enjoyment of life. It is one element submitted, one which our courts have said is a factor in that, in the pain and mental anguish. Again, bottom line, have they been harmed? Where do they claim that that finding is not supported by the facts or the evidence? Where do they claim that that amount is excessive? They do not. They do not for that issue. But yet they want you to reverse a trial that lasted approximately a month on that type of issue. Your Honor, the bottom line to all of this is that this appeal, quite frankly, does not raise anything that requires reversal. All of the constitutional issues have been answered previously and rejected, and I think the question by Judge Doggett earlier about what circuits have adopted their position, none that I know of, on repeated awards, I'll say the Third Circuit within the last week has rejected their argument again in the case of Dunn versus Owens Corning.
Have you submitted that in a supplemental brief?
I didn't find out about it till this morning.
Would you do so?
I'd be happy to. So their argument has been repeatedly objected. They're coming here asking you to throw out our Texas common law method as holding it unconstitutional per se without any underlying argument. And The autopsy pictures are discretionary. The Sumner Simpson limited instruction, again, is discretionary. There's simply no basis for reversal in that regard. I want to address in my time remaining the Firebird argument on Williams versus Steve's Industry. It's important to note, they're not raising a no evidence point. They're saying that the Court of Appeals misapplied the Williams case. The Court of Appeals looked at Firebird and Garlock, reversed as to Garlock, saying no evidence to support the gross negligence finding. It upheld the Firebird largely because of admissions by Firebird. They admitted they never studied. They admitted that the plaintiffs were foreseeable users. They admitted they sold the products. The plaintiff and the purchasing agent at Texas Eastman both testified that there was no warning. Firebird disputes that. But the purchasing agent at Texas Eastman, a disinterested party, says no warning. If we will look on page 572 of the Williams versus Steve's Industries opinion, the court, as to Firebird, it boils down to this, it seems to me. The court details out what test the plaintiff can use in proving gross negligence. And it says, and the court says on page 573, we reaffirm our holding in Burke Royalty that the plaintiff need not prove the defendant's subjective state of mind by direct evidence, and sets out both an objective and a subjective test for proving gross negligence. We have met that test. In my opinion, we're required to prove the following things. One, an extreme degree of risk. Number two, that a reasonable person would have realized his conduct created an extreme degree of risk. Number three, a related act or omission that causes the harm. And then, if you prove those things, the jury may find that the defendant made a conscious decision to ignore the rights of others. Those elements are detailed out if you read Williams on page 572 and 573. We put specific evidence on each of those elements, an extreme degree of risk, death and suffering, through a historical search of the literature because of the nature of disease, all by expert testimony. That reasonable persons would have realized his conduct created the risk. We had expert testimony. Dr. Wagner testified to that issue. In addition, we had other manufacturers testify they knew.
Counsel, your time has expired. Are there any questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Sadler suggests that it's inappropriate to contend that these defendants have been punished enough. In fact, as of today, Owens, Illinois has paid some $1.3 million in punitive awards. It has $4 million in additional awards assessed against it. The record in this case establishes that at the time of this verdict, Celotex was in 65,000 cases. Celotex had spent $250 million on asbestos claims.
What about Mr. Sadler's claim that you could have moved for a class consolidation?
Your Honor.
And therefore, reduce both the defense costs that you say we should consider, as well as the possibility of $5 million in punitive damages in each trial.
Our experience in this litigation has been that both consolidation and class action treatment are highly prejudicial to the defendants for a number of different reasons. One is you tend to group different disease categories. And our experience has been that juries tend to assume that the plaintiffs with the lesser disease will get the disease that the plaintiffs who are more seriously hurt at trial have, whether the medical evidence supports that or not. The experience has also been that after you get past a certain number, the juries just lump all the plaintiffs together, treat them alike in terms of damages. I also think it is a fact that both sides of this litigation have opposed both class action treatment and, in addition, treatment within the federal courts under the multi-district litigation. Mr. Sadler suggests that this case wasn't a class action. We just had five plaintiffs. All we tried were punitive damages for the five plaintiffs. We did not try the magnitude of the harm. The record in this case is inconsistent with that. From voir dire through closing, they talked not about the harm to their five plaintiffs, but they talked about harm to tens and tens of thousands of workers. They introduced evidence through their medical experts that between 2.7 and 4.1 million workers would develop an asbestos disease because of, allegedly, these defendants' conduct. They specifically suggested that that was a reason why the jury should award large punitive damages in this case. Have we been punished enough? I suggest we have. Mr. Sadler suggests that we've not. What we're asking this court for today is to give us a procedural mechanism like that approved by the United States Supreme Court that will let us take this argument that we're making to the trial judge, will allow both sides to introduce evidence on the question, will give the trial court some instructions, some guidance, some factors, and allow the trial court, as a trier of fact, as a decision maker, to make that determination.
Did you ask for a miniature in this case on the basis of the particular evidence introduced in this case?
No. What we asked for was that the punitive damages be set aside
in their entirety.
Is Mr. Sadler correct that as far as this court's concerned, we don't have any excessiveness issue or any no evidence issue or any sufficiency of the issue of the evidence?
We have not brought forward any of those specific complaints to this court. Our challenge to the punitive damage award goes to the award in its entirety.
Doesn't that make the photographs argument moot? I mean, surely it's not a question of an improper verdict on liability. You're not saying an improper verdict on liability was rendered by the jury because they saw these photographs.
I'm saying exactly that, Your Honor. And as authority for that proposition, I refer this court to its Hedden decision. Hedden was a condemnation case involving condemnation for a pipeline. There was evidence introduced about pipeline explosions that would diminish the value of the property. In connection with that argument, photographs of dead cows, cattle carcasses, were introduced into evidence. This court held in Hedden that those photographs did not show anything material with respect to a disputed issue.
But are you saying that these photographs did not show the cause of death?
I'm saying exactly that, and I'll discuss that in just a minute. Assuming that to be the case, I think this court's Hedden decision establishes that the photographs probably caused the rendition of an improper verdict. Your Honor, our defense on the medical or the causation part of this case had nothing to do with Haline plaques. We conceded the existence of Haline plaques. Our defense that asbestos was a cause of Mr. Freeman's lung cancer was based on two things. First, his longtime history of cigarette smoking, and second, the fact that no asbestos bodies were found in his lungs. Again, Haline plaques has nothing to do with that. We did not contest. There was no controversy about Haline plaques. They proved that up through Dr. Gonzalez and through the autopsy report, and there was no need for this jury to see those blood and guts photographs.
Did those photographs, were you able to show that they did not show any asbestos?
Absolutely.
You were able to use the photographs as well.
We did not use the photographs on that point. They are expert, Your Honor. Dr. Gonzalez conceded and admitted that there were no asbestos bodies within Mr. Freeman's lungs. His autopsy report confirmed that, and it is on the strength of those undisputed facts that we argued the causation issue. The photographs show nothing material with respect to anything that was in dispute on the medical aspect of this case, one side or the other. Mr. Sadler suggested that our limiting instruction was overbroad. He mentioned Judge Hall. Judge Hall, in fact, now requires by standing order that limiting instructions, just like the ones we tendered, be given in all of his asbestos cases. Mr. Sadler mentioned the King case.
Is that in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. It's attached, the standing order is attached as an exhibit or addendum to one of our briefs. Mr. Sadler mentioned the King case. In King, limiting instruction of the type that we requested was given. There was no issue on appeal about that, but the Fifth Circuit made a point of dropping a footnote and pointing out that this kind of limiting instruction had been given. And in fact, the Texarkana Court appeals, and the Texarkana Court agreed that at least one of the limiting instructions we requested was not overly broad, it was proper, and it could have been submitted by this trial court. Mr. Sadler suggests, well, I've got some evidence against Owens, Illinois, and some evidence against these other defendants, so Sumner Simpson doesn't matter. Your Honors, we can deal with our company documents. We've got documents that can put those into perspective. We've got witnesses by deposition otherwise that can explain those and discuss them. The point is, when evidence from the files, the private files of a non-party company, that were created a couple of decades before we get into this or got into this business are introduced against us. And they're evidence of not of information but of misconduct and wrongdoing. In that situation, we are absolutely helpless to deal with that evidence, and I suggest the record supports the inference that this jury did with that evidence exactly what plaintiff's counsel asked them to do.
Can you concede that the Fifth Circuit has upheld verdicts which admitted the precise of these same exhibits without any limiting instruction?
I do not concede that. I'm familiar specifically with the Jackson case. In Jackson, the only defendants were Revestis Manhattan and Johns Manville. Those are the authors of the Sumner Simpson documents. I think the King case was the first case in which the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the admission of this evidence in a case in which JM and Revestis Manhattan were not parties. King was the case in which the Fifth Circuit dropped the footnote and pointed out that the trial court had given a limiting instruction of the type that we requested, in which the Texarkana court said would, in fact, have been proper. Unless there are some additional questions, I owe Mr. Conan a minute or two.
Mr. Sadler said that there had been an expert who testified that the dust emitted from Garlock was sufficient to cause risk to human health. That is simply not the case. Justice Doggett put his finger on it in opening when he pointed to the sum total of the evidence from the plaintiffs. A doctor said a small amount of asbestos can affect the disease process. One of the plaintiffs testified that working with the Garlock gaskets was dusty. That's it. That does not meet the standards required by this court that the plaintiff prove unreasonable dangerousness of a particular product from a particular manufacturer. That does not meet the standards set by this and other courts that the plaintiff prove a substantial contribution to the plaintiff's condition from the particular product. The only product-specific evidence in this record with respect to Garlock came from Dr. Cooper, who said that the amount was so minuscule that it could not conceivably affect human health. There was no evidence to the contrary.
Any questions? Thank you. That concludes the arguments this morning. The foregoing calls are all submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will soon return the court.
Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.